Blog Talk Radio. Radio.
At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and I want to welcome the callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. If you have logged in as a guest and wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I will also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions or make a comment. And chatters, I want to hear from you tonight, and I'm seeing the switchboard is really, we're getting a lot of people on the switchboard, so that is wonderful. So following the show, though, you can continue this discussion on the Genealogy and History Forum of Afrogenius.com and Research at the National Archives and Beyond Facebook page. In fact, we both have Facebook pages, so, hey, like us. I want to give a special thanks to the Blog Talk Radio team for featuring this show all day today. Well, the topic for tonight's show is Got Proof, My Genealogical Journey Through the Use of Documentation. Now, how many of you are in the midst of writing your family story? Do you have all the necessary documentation to support that story? Well, my guest tonight will take you on an exciting journey. In fact, he was a guest on the show on November 3rd, 2011. In fact, the first guest when I became research at the National Archives and Beyond, and he spoke of his journey of finding Agnes Mathieu. Well, I also met my guest. I met him at the National Archives, and I can tell you, Michael Henderson lit up the National Archives. He had so much energy and so much enthusiasm, and the only thing I could think of is he has proud ancestors. They have to be proud of him because he was able to uncover so much about his family, the kind of documents that all of us wish we could find. Michael Henderson found them on his family. Well, in God Proof, My Genealogical Journey Through the Use of Documentation, Lieutenant Commander Michael Nolden Henderson, USN retired, captures the attention of genealogists, historians, and others interested in the complex social structure that developed during the French and Spanish colonial periods in Louisiana. He explores the forbidden relationships which evolved the unique Creole culture, revealing original documents well as far back as the 1770s. Now, he uses his own experiences as a family history researcher, as well as the insight of noted scholars to reveal the methods, the standards, and the techniques used to prove his ancestry. So I want to give a warm welcome to Michael Nolden Henderson to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Michael, welcome.
Hi, Bernice. How are you doing this evening?
Just fine, Michael. I don't know what happened. I must have muted you.
Yeah, I don't know what happened either, but I'm glad that we made contact. How's everything this evening?
Oh, just great, Michael. You know, I was just talking about all of that energy you had, how you lit up the National Archives.
Yeah, it was really fantastic to have a chance to finally get a chance to meet you at the National Archives. I believe it was last June. I was back in Washington, D.C., and to be able to actually come full circle and meet you after having been on your show for that first time back in November, it was a joy to meet you. And when I saw you for the first time, I realized that I was looking at someone who had the same passion and enthusiasm about family history. And it was basically, we just talked and talked and talked and had a great time.
Yes, and I think that was when Anita said, it's time to write that book.
I think that was the spark that was placed under me for, I cannot tell you how long it has been to get to the point of realizing that the story needed to be actually told in such a way that it was going to manifest in what has turned out to be God-proof. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, I love God-proof. I've read it 3 times, and I love the cover. So tell us, I mean, you have this beautiful woman on the front of your book. Tell us about this photo.
This is my grandmother. Her name was Nellie Mathieu, M-A-T-H-I-E-U. It is my mother's mother. I chose her picture because it's my primary link into the story that's going to be unfolding here. The cover itself, the elements that were chosen for the cover, tells a story. And it was designed in such a way that if you look at the front of the cover, they always say you never judge a book by its cover, but I wanted to go against that whole saying and saying, I want you to look at the cover and actually understand that there are some elements that basically will tell a lot. And once you read the book and get to the end of the book, you go back to the front of the cover and realize that everything that's on the cover has some meaning. But that lady is my grandmother. Her name is Nellie Mathieu, and she was my first link into the Mathieu line, which I later traced to my fourth generation great-grandmother, Agnes, who the story is really about and her discovering.
Right. Well, let's start at the beginning. Now, how did you get started in genealogy?
Well, I believe, like everyone, you really don't know exactly when you get started doing genealogy. However, for me particularly, there were certain points in my early life that I found myself curious, just like everyone else. You're curious about your surroundings, things that go on in the family. You're curious about the various members in the family that you're meeting, but you don't know exactly how they all come together. And for me in particular, I found myself at various times meeting new cousins and relatives, and these particular meeting occasions were generally at funerals. And I found myself asking questions of my mom about these different relatives that we were meeting and why we all look so different. And I got into a conversation one day with her and asked her the question about her mother, Nellie. And she began to tell me the story about the family being French Creole. I asked her, I said, why is your mother's maiden name spelled M-A-T-H-I-E-U, Mathieu? And she had relayed to me that the family was French Creole, and that was just the way they spelt the name. But then I realized that it was more to the story than it was just that's the way we spell the name. And then she passed on to me that she didn't know a great deal about the history of the family, that particular side of the family, because her mother, at the age when she was only 6 years old, my mom, died. And so I realized then it was a moment in time for me to realize that my mom was still alive, passing on to me information that was critical to her. Up until that time, we never talked about that, the passing of her mom. And then from that moment on, I realized that this unique spelling of the name possibly meant something, and that kind of caused me to go on this journey of trying to, you know, learn more about this side of the family itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were some of the oral history traditions in your family beyond talking to your mother?
Well, like everything else, you find as young children, you oftentimes we would sit around the elders as they gather around the homestead, and while the elders were having these conversations, the kids were off playing, doing whatever they were doing as kids. But I was always one that was that sat very close by. I was just amazed at the different types of stories that they would share amongst themselves, my mother, her sisters, her aunts. And I realized that the majority of it was borderlining on gossip, who was doing what to whom, when, where. And when some of them were realizing that I was paying close attention, all of a sudden I noticed the language would change. I didn't know exactly what it was they were speaking, but it turned out that they were speaking this language called French Creole. My mother's mother was the last generation in that family line to speak French Creole in the family. My mom was actually forced to have to learn speak English. And so, but she picked up a few words, a few phrases and things like that so they could communicate. But my generation basically, you know, went through the process of just speaking English and things like that. And there were stories that they would tell amongst themselves, but they would never go beyond the two or three generations that were sitting around the table and things like that. And it was just that childhood curiosity of various little things I would remember that was not clear to me. No one would actually explain to me exactly how these various relatives that would come around and visit and things like that, how we were all related in terms of, you know, aunts, uncles, cousins, and those types of things. We were just all related. And as I got older and went away, I left Louisiana right after I graduated from college and entered into the military. And I was finding that folks were very fascinated by, you know, the place that I grew up in. And I tell folks all the time is you don't really appreciate home until you leave away and have somebody else talk all about it. And I realized then that during my military relief periods, when I would go home, I would see the city that I grew up in anew, as mm-hmm. if those individuals that were bragging about, you know, coming to New Orleans, you know, spending time down, having a great time and things like that. And so what I found myself having to do is having a different appreciation for the family, the connection, the culture, are totally different than I did growing up. There's an old saying, you can't see the forest for the trees, or until you come or lose something, then you have a greater appreciation. And what I started to find out is that as I got older and some of these older relatives that would sit around and talk with my mom and her aunts and her cousins were starting to die off, mm-hmm. a lot of the things that now I'm interested in, I'm starting to lose. I found myself asking a lot of questions, trying to get as much information as I possibly could from these individuals. And I was now starting to be impacted by the fact that a lot of these individuals were being lost due to death. And so I started gathering facts and figures just like everyone else. And I realized what I was doing now is I had this thirst and this hunger, this curiosity, so wanting to put down on paper as much as I could, as quick as I could, before I would lose all of this history that I'd grown so fond of as a young child. And so it set me off on this motion of actually starting the gathering and collecting and, you know, trying to assort all of the data that I was putting together. But I really had no concept of exactly the order in which it was going to take place. I was just gathering, collecting. My mom was and her aunts would collect these obituaries. They were like mini biographies of a person when they died. And I suddenly realized that there was a lot of information that was that was inside these mini biographies that helped me to start to build these family group sheets and these pedigree charts as I was assembling all of the documentation that I started to need. But what was happening is I just had names and a few relationships, connections, like who was married to whom and that type of a thing. But I had no actual documents to tie it all together. And then when I realized that I was starting to do the rudimentary part of genealogy, where you're gathering, you're trying to establish, you know, who begot who. In other words, I started assembling my mother, father, their mothers and fathers as far back as I could go. Then I would go back to my mother or my dad, and I said, you know, what else could you tell me about these various branches that I'm now starting to look at? And they would tell me as much as they could. As I mentioned, my mom was only able to go back so far. I think we got back to her mother before she died, and that was it in terms of me being able to assemble any additional information. And she took me over to visit another cousin, which I later determined was her second cousin, my second cousin once removed, and she started to share some additional information with me, and lo and behold, she turned out to be somewhat of the family historian. I didn't know this at the time, but she was waiting for someone to come along with the enthusiasm that I was actually showing and demonstrating to pass something on to the next generation, and I just happened to fit that bill. While sitting down talking with this person, there were three critical pieces of information that she gave me to get me started to go beyond just my mom, the lady, my mother's mother, the lady that's on the book. She gave me a kind of a wire diagram from Nellie up to this woman that I later determined was Agnes, which was my fourth generation grandmother. She also gave me a piece of oral history that I'll talk about briefly, but she pulled out this picture, this photograph of my mother's mother's mother and father. So it was my great-grandparents. My mom had never seen the picture of her grandparents. And
oh,
to be in
wow.
a position of watching this exchange between these two cousins coming along, I was in a privileged position once again to see my mom seeing for the first time her grandmother and grandfather. And just prior to us leaving that first visit, she also provided some additional information about this woman, Nellie, that was the fourth generation grandmother. It was, Agnes. The lady on the book's name is Agnes. The fourth generation grandmother was Agnes. And what we did was she started explaining to me some of the things that she knew that was passed down to her, and it was a piece of oral history, and it went like this. They wouldn't allow us to use Daddy's last name. One of the daughters of Agnes, for some reason, was able to get that down to this lady, and she shared that with my mom and I, and it opened up a door for me to realize that there was some history that I needed to learn, that I needed to find more about. Like I said, my mom was not aware of none of this history because of the fact it was closely held, and she was basically the last one, this cousin, to hold this piece of information. It was like she was revealing it to this new set of eyes, new set of ears for the very first time, and I just had a whole bunch of questions. One, what was Daddy's last name? Why didn't they not allow whomever to use Daddy's last name, and what was the whole essence behind that piece of oral history? And that set me off to going out to search about this particular story. So that day I left with a picture. I left with a line diagram from my grandmother to her great-grandmother, and then I had this picture of my great-grandparents.
Wow. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. I mean, just to, you know, you said three words, thirst. You had that thirst. You had mm-hmm. that curiosity, and you had that hunger. And then you had this individual there to provide you with a family diagram. Oh, my goodness. And pictures? Oh, I could imagine. How did that feel?
Well, the thing about it is that, again, I was in the moment. I was not trying to.
I'm in the moment, just listening to it.
It was one of those times when you're getting something, you don't really have an appreciation for all that you're getting. And what I tried to do in capturing the story by telling it in the book is to let folks know that as you're going through this journey, there are things that are happening to you during the moment that you don't have the full impact at that time. Even just to be able to talk with this elder and how you're communicating with that particular person, because up until this time, I was of the belief that no one had expressed the type of enthusiasm about wanting to know about the family history as much as I did. And I tell folks, I said, when you're approaching an elder, you have to come there with a sense of humility. You have to be in a somewhat humble state, because they want to share information with you, but unless you come to them the right way, you may not get everything that you're looking for the very first time. I just happened to get what I wanted on that first visit, but it set into motion me to be able to visit several more times later on during this journey.
Wow, and you're so right about being in a humble state, because they're there to share, but if you stop them, you might not get any more.
Right. So I let her talk as much as she wanted to talk and wanted to share, and she saw that, I was not trying to compile facts and figures about the family for any malicious purposes and everything. And I think that oftentimes when you start to dig deep into one's family's history, the first thing your relatives will want to, well, what are you going to do with it? And how are you going to display it? What are you going to tell? Why are you so concerned about this? And I have to constantly reassure individuals that I gather information from. It's so that I could learn the history of our family in such a way that I could help communicate it, because no one has done it at the level in which I'm about to do it now. And I want to be able to, one, allow you to trust me with that information, so when I build the family tree and then put the meat on the bones, because when you think about the pedigree chart, it's basically like a skeleton. I tell folks all the time, genealogy is like the skeleton of a human body. And when you place the meat, the history, you're actually forming this human body to tell a story. And the thing about it is when you combine the two, genealogy and family history together, you develop this mosaic or this picture of individuals that have come before you. Oftentimes I find myself walking back in time through the various generations, and I can call out a particular ancestor that lived at a particular time period, and it's almost as if I'm reliving their life again, because all of the things I've learned about these particular individuals. Now, from me to this woman, Agnes, that I talk about, it's seven generations. So this journey of discovering Agnes had to matriculate through seven generations, and my challenge or my task at hand was to document so that I could get to the point of answering the question why they wouldn't allow us to use Daddy's last name. And so the next phase of this process that I found myself going through after this tremendous amount of curiosity that I developed over this time period was I started to assemble documents. I started gathering baptism, birth records, marriage records, death records. Those are those primary documents that bring together an understanding of the beginning of one's life, of something that is done during a person's life, and then at the end of the life. Those are the three main documents that ties it all together. But in Louisiana, primarily because of the fact that the records were kept so well and within the Catholic Church, I was fortunate enough to be able to compile baptism, birth, marriage, and death records for seven generations from myself all the way to this person called Agnes. And in assembling these documents, I started to see how the families were connected in such a way where I'm finding documents of the children, the parents, at each generation. And I'm looking at the documents in such a way that I'm able to tell individual stories about where they were born, when they got married, when they died, what were the cause of their death. And so these individual stories were able to be developed along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, we're going to take a break. Come back, because I want you to tell us more about where you found these documents, because it's wonderful to hear that you gathered, but we need to also figure out where did you get them, and about the resources that are available in Louisiana to help you with this journey. So we're going to take a quick break and then come back. And Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and you can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will have an expert to share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. Remember, all of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. Now, all of my shows are available as a podcast immediately after the broadcast, and they can be downloaded from iTunes. Now, I'm opening up the phone line so that individuals who would like to call in, who would like to make a comment, if you've read the book and you want to say something about the book, please feel free to call. Also, chatters, I'd love to have your questions for Michael Henderson. The call-in number is 646-200-0491, and then you can press 1 to speak to the host. Now, Michael, you just mentioned that you gathered documents, birth, baptism, marriage, and death records. And since documentation plays such a key role in being able to tell your story, please, you know, just walk us through the various sources you use to tell your story.
Well, first of all, Denise, the types of documents that I explained earlier, the baptism, birth records, marriage records, these are records that are normally kept within the individual household. Interestingly enough, for me, my mom was the depository of a lot of the records. I mean, she maintained our baptism records. She had our birth records. She maintained her marriage records. So I just started assembling the various documents. I tell people oftentimes, I say, when you're getting ready to go on this journey of discovery, start with yourself. Try to gather as much as you could at your own location. Once I did that, I was able to assemble all of the documents of my siblings. I got the necessary information from my mom and my dad about their marriage. And then I proceeded to find the person in our family that may have held documents of the grandparents that were alive. I can remember that my grandfather on my mother's side, my maternal grandfather, I remember growing up with him. I did not know his wife, Nellie, that's on the picture, but my mom had this small newspaper clipping on an obituary, and that was my window into who this woman was. That was all that I knew at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it lists a lot of great information on the obituary itself, and I was able to extract from that obituary the names of her parents, But again, that was it. Her siblings. There were some other information that was pertinent to me, where she was buried, the day she was born, those types of things. So I started assembling as much as I could within the family household itself. And then once I exhausted that, I went to the next generation, from my generation to my mom's generation, and then my mom's generation to her mother and father's generation. Then I replicated the same process. I looked for places where those types of records would have been kept. Baptism records would have been kept through the archdiocese, and since the family was Catholic, the Archdiocese of New Orleans maintained our baptism records and things like that. The vital records, which was the birth records and the marriage records and the death records, was kept at the Office of Vital Records in New Orleans itself. And at a certain time period, I think it's 50 years back, you can get records at the New Orleans Vital Records Office. But beyond that, you had to go to the Louisiana State Archives in Baton Rouge and to be able to get copies of baptism records and marriage records and death records and those types of things. So I utilized those three, the Archdiocese of New Orleans to gather the baptism records, the vital records of New Orleans, and then the Louisiana State Archives to get those three primary documents that I talked about. Then once I was able to create a pedigree chart for about four generations to my great-grandparents, and I started assembling these documents so that I, you know, clearly have a straight line all the way back with these various documents. And the reason why I was doing this because I wanted to become the archivist of the family. I wanted to do the things that my mom was already doing naturally, just assembling the documents. And here it is. I'm the next generation below. Then when I realized that there were other records that I could start to look at, like census records, and starting to learn how the census records worked. And I remember when the 1930 census came available, I wanted to see if I could find my parents on the 1930 census. And lo and behold, my dad, having been born in 1929, was about 1 year old in 1930. And when I saw him with his mother, father, and his grandparents on the 1930 census, that was like a first government record, you know, that was outside the family's household that I saw. Wow, I said, wow, he's now on this particular document. I found my mom in the 1930 census also because they were born in the same year. And then I started looking and started accumulating other records. And like I said, when I met this cousin that my mom took me over to visit, she gave me this wire diagram of the family, but there were no records that came along with it other than the names. And it was critical because then I was able to take the census records and actually look for those names in the 1930, the 1920, the 1910, the 1900, the 1880, 1870, 1860, 1850, 40, and was able to go all the way back to the 1810, where I actually found Agnes on the 1810 census. Now, keep in mind, this is all before I found out or was told that as an African-American, you oftentimes run into this what's called a proverbial brick wall of going beyond the 1870 census. And I was not having that challenge with this particular line. As I mentioned, I was able to go all the way back to the 1810 census where I found Agnes's name, and she had her full name, Agnes Mathieu. And so that right there caused me to wonder and, you know, look further into how could that happen? How could she be on the 1810 census when everyone else was saying? And so now I found myself now having to become not only the family archivist, but also the local family historian. Mm-hmm. I had to immerse myself with the local history because, as I mentioned, I was I was seeking this mystery. I was trying to understand this family oral history that had been passed on to me by this cousin about why they wouldn't allow us to use Daddy's last name. And I tell family historians and genealogists, when you get ready to start to study your family in the context of where the communities in which they live, you really need to know about the local history. You need to immerse yourself in what was going on in the various time periods. Now, I'm going through seven generations now. I'm looking at seven generations of different records. So each generation, there was a piece of history that they were tied to that the family overlaid into the families. So I had to become familiar. And when I laid all of the documents out, seven generations, I had to understand how they matriculated through time, through the local history, and what impact the local history had on their individual life. And that was probably the most challenging thing, because I'm now starting to have a better understanding of Louisiana and those individuals that lived in Louisiana and the time period in which Louisiana evolved in. And
well, we have
living
a question.
In Louisiana.
Yes, mm-hmm. Well, we have a question coming out of the chat, and let's look at Agnes. It said, did you know, was there any unusual story that surfaced from the family history? And you're saying you're now putting the history in the context of where you're finding your ancestors. So you found Agnes in the 1810 U.S. Census. Was there any surprises, anything special that you then started to pick up?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to understand was, how was it that I was able to find Agnes in the 1810 census? Well, one, she had to be free because she was listed as Agnes Mathieu, so she was carrying her first and surname, and I wanted to see if I could, you know, make a connection, see if I could find Agnes's parents, which was a difficult task for me because, again, I learned that with this conversation that I had with this cousin was that one of the daughters said they wouldn't allow us to use Daddy's last name, but she also shared with me that it was a story about this woman of color who had a relationship with this white European, and I believe that was part of the reason why the shrouding of the mystery of why folks did not talk about that to the children or the kids and everything is because there was another piece, another layer that was shared with them at the time. Well, Agnes was a woman of color who had a relationship with the Frenchman, and this relationship was at the time considered illegal because, again, having studied the history, the local history of Louisiana, it was illegal for white Europeans or Europeans to have relationships with women of color, to either marry, to live with, to produce children. So now I'm having to understand, where did that start? How did that generate? Where did that come from? And it took me all the way back to the 1724 time period during the French colonial period, where Louisiana under the French control, and I'll give you a quick little tutorial about Spanish and French colonial Louisiana. Louisiana was founded in 1699 by two French-Canadian brothers and a band of soldiers that actually settled down in Mobile. In 1699, in 1718, the city of New Orleans was founded by Jean-Baptiste Lemon Bienville, which was the younger brother, Pierre and Jean-Baptiste. From 1718 to 1763, Louisiana was under the French control. Now, they started to import African slaves into Louisiana around 1719, but prior to that, the French Canadian and the settlers that came into Louisiana from 1699 until that time period were already starting to live and scout out and discover the outlying areas, and they were forming relationships with Native Americans at the time. And so these relationships between these French Canadians and these Native Americans started to produce a group of mixed-raced individuals. In 1724, there were some concerns about these mixed-race individuals possibly overpopulating French colonial Louisiana. And so they came out with this series of codes, which was called the Code Noir, the Black Code, French Code Noir. And in these codes, which is about 56 to 60 different codes, it regulated how these white Europeans would relate to these newly arriving African slaves that were coming in, and the relationships between the Native Americans and things like that. And so now I have to immerse myself in the rules and regulation of French colonial Louisiana. Now, I found out in the code that it was illegal for a white European to marry, to have a relationship, to produce children by these Native Americans or these Africans that are coming in to Louisiana. So I took it for gospel, as if everything was to go the way it was supposed to go, and everybody was following the rules. I used that as somewhat of a guidebook for me to be able to now try to help to understand. But thinking about it was not necessarily the rules were followed. Those that were able to read, usually those that were in control, basically used the rules to their benefits. Trying to imagine you have enslaved Africans and Native Americans, illiterate. They can't read. They don't know the code existed. So here it is. You have a set of laws that have been immersed, planted on top of you, and it's regulating your life in the life expectancy. So having an appreciation for how the codes were put in place, it allowed me to now have an appreciation also for how this relationship would later form between my French ancestor, Mathieu, and his consort, Agnes. So now I'm trying to get a better understanding that here I find Agnes in the 1810 census, and I'm told that she has a relationship with this white European, but she's free in 1810. Can I go back any further and find out when she was born, who her parents were? And as I started going back in time, looking for the types of documents that I might need, one of the things that I remembered this cousin told me that she was an enslaved woman at one point in time who gained her freedom. Now, again, these pieces of information that were given to me by this cousin, it allowed me to then go back and now understand Agnes is free in 1810, and she's on the census records. If I go back further, can I find her in being enslaved at any point in time? There is a professor of history. Her name is Gwendolyn Hall, and in 1999, she produced this massive study on Africans in colonial Louisiana, and she produced this slave database. And in her database, she listed over 100,000 Africans or enslaved Africans that were brought in to Louisiana that lived in Louisiana between, I think the period was 1719 to about 1820. And in her database, she was able to categorize these individuals that had come, that were brought into French colonial Louisiana, and various identification markings and things like that. And this database itself allowed me to then search to see if I could locate any of my ancestors that I knew up until that time. And lo and behold, I plugged in the name Agnes and was able to find her in the free section of the database. But then I went back even further and was able to find her in the slave side of the database. And what Dr. Hall allowed for me to be able to do was find a specific document, and she lists the number that the document was listed in and where it was located. And when I went to locate the document, pull the document, I found her manumission document. The document was written in Spanish, and this document was somewhat of a window to the history of my family that no one from myself to my mom, my cousin knew anything about. And so it set into motion something for me that allowed me to be able to piece all of the information together to Agnes and then now find her manumission document. The manumission document was a seven-page document, and in the document itself, it tells a story of how Agnes was able to gain her freedom. And as I mentioned, it was written in Spanish. When I went over to the Notorial Archives, where the document was actually housed, and it is actually still there, the lady that helped me, for one, locate the document there was the archivist at the Notorial Archives. And she said, "Oh, we have a rather interesting document here. It's a rather large document, and there's an interesting signature on the document." And I said, "Well, can you give me a cursory summary of what it is telling me?" And I'm like this child waiting for this good news to come along. And she said, "Well, it seemed like there's this court case that's taken place." And this person who is enslaved is looking to gain her freedom and has petitioned the courts, the Spanish court at the time. And there seemed like there's some problem because it's going to take some while. But she didn't have time to go through the whole process. And she told me, but this is the document that you've come in here for, and this is your document. And I left that day realizing that I found one, a slave document that gave my ancestor her freedom. Another interesting aspect about this particular document was the time period in which she gained her freedom. And that right there was another interesting aspect because it tells the story of not only Spanish colonial Louisiana slavery with my ancestors playing a part in it, but it connected my ancestor to another person who helped her gain her freedom, and lo and behold, I found out that it was my fourth-generation great-grandfather, who turned out to be a local militia guy that served in the local militia. As I mentioned, 1779 was a critical time period in New Orleans, primarily because it was around the time when America, as we knew as the 13 colonies, Louisiana was outside the 13 colonies, was going through what we call the American Revolution. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that took place between 1776 to 1783. And so when I found this document in the date or time period in which this other part of history was going on, I realized that my ancestor life was being played out while something else much bigger was being played out on the national stage, which we consider right now America. And that was a connection right there. So that's the story in and of itself of this one main document, this freedom paper that I was able to locate. And,
well, you have a couple of questions coming out of the chat. First of all, what was the freedom resulting from? They want to know a little bit more of that story. And there's another question, was she freed upon his death, and what caused him to manumit her? Now, I want to tell the chatters, it's in the book. You need to read the book. Get the book. This is a very interesting story. And this is a story that we saw on the PBS. Is that correct?
Right. That is correct. What it was a document, an element that I utilized to tie my family's local history to Spanish colonial Louisiana, but also connected to American history, and that's why we chose to do it in the form of what was called the Galvez Papers, because it had a much broader meaning. One, that the fact that Louisiana participated in the American Revolution. And I was not in school when I was living in Louisiana, high school, elementary school, had no awareness that Louisiana participated in the American Revolution. We were taught the 13 colonies along the East Coast. But then here I am, I'm finding a document that's dated in 1779. It gave her freedom. She was born in French colonial Louisiana in 1759. And when the Spanish took over in 1763, the Code Noir, the French codes that were in place, in some instances were relaxed in such a way that the Spanish saw ways or was looking for ways to increase its population when it took over. And so you had these skilled enslaved individuals who could provide a service, and the Spanish government realized that they could offer them an opportunity to purchase their freedom, relax the laws in such a way. There was this system called cortancia. It means self-purchase. It gave the enslaved individual a right to purchase their individual freedom. Oftentimes, they could just there was a determinant factor of how much they were valued, how much they were worth, based on their owner's ownership of that. The slave was able to raise money by working. And we talk about this. We share a little bit about this in the Galvez papers, but I also talk a little bit about it in the book. But it was a critical time for Agnes because in 1779, and what's really interesting is today is June 20th, June 21st, 1779, Louisiana entered into the struggle for the independence that the Americans were dealing with. In other words, they actually declared war on Great Britain. It was May 8th that Spain declared war on Great Britain. But by the time back then, there wasn't an internet. There was no email. There was no way of getting the message. By the time it got to Louisiana, it was around June 21st, 1779, that General Bernardo Galvez, who was the Spanish colonial governor at the time, rallied his militia and Spanish forces and marched on to Baton Rouge and Natchez and later on to Mobile and Pensacola. So all of this was going on while my ancestor, Agnes, about a little less than three months later, was about to get her freedom. And so all of this was now starting to, you know, play a part. I needed to figure out how all of this was happening. How could this happen? And how could the Spanish colonial governor, Bernardo Galvez, play an intricate part in the freedom of my fourth generation great-grandmother?
Well,
he actually signed her manumission.
I need you to hold that thought because I do have a caller online who wants to say something, and then we can come back and talk about it again. Okay, so that's
okay.
Area code 404. You have a question or a comment?
Yes. My name is Jane, and I'm from Atlanta. I'd like for the author to tell us the significance of the symbolism that's on the cover of the book. It's quite interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about the different symbols on the cover of the book as well as the code on the back of the book?
That's an interesting question. I appreciate that, Jane, for doing that. What I want to do is rather than explaining all of the symbology of the book itself, because there are many folks that probably have not seen it, or that you may have, but as I mentioned, that is my grandmother, Nellie. The symbol on the cover of the book itself, the little symbol in the lower right hand in the middle of the book, it's a burial medallion that is presented or is placed at the grave site of a patriot of the American Revolution. When a descendant is able to trace their ancestry back to a patriot of the American Revolution, there is a ceremony that the sons and daughters of the American Revolution conduct. In turn, this is called a patriotic grave marking, and this is an emblem that is actually placed at the gravestone or at the grave site itself. The DR has a similar emblem, but this right here represents the sons of the American Revolution. The document that you see on the document on the page of the book itself is actually the front and back page of an seven-page document of the manumission, and you can actually see the signature of Bernardo Galvez. It's right next to that symbol. There are a couple of other elements. Because it's written in Spanish, it may be hard or difficult for you to see, but right above the fleur-de-lis, which is the French little symbol next to my name, there's the Spanish word liberté, which means freedom. And there, in the document itself, embedded in the document, is the gentleman who assisted Agnes, my fourth generation grandmother, to gain her freedom. I chose this symbology, the symbolism of for my book cover because it's almost like a cliff note of what the book is about. The book gets into greater detail of how I I discovered all in which I was able to discover, but I take you on this journey and let you see the process, not so much a step-by-step of how the genealogy, but how I was able to piece it together in such a way that I tell you stories. And I tell folks, you may look at it for the first time and you may not understand it, but by the time you get to the end of the book, you'll be able to look at the front of the page, or the front of the book, and realize that this is why all of these things were chosen.
Yes, and it's just beautiful. And caller, thank you so much for calling in to ask that question. Well, I just wanted to ask a few more questions. I hope you don't mind. We're going to extend the call just a few minutes longer, Michael. And so we're going to take a break and then come back, and then just a few minutes long, I want you to talk about the lineage societies and your involvement in that.
Okay.
Everyone back. This is the last portion of our discussion about God genealogy, God proof, my genealogical journey through the use of documentation. And it's just wonderful to hear that Michael was able to find all kinds of documents about his family. But Michael, you know, as I listen to you, I mean, you are a storyteller, you are a researcher. And I realized that you were able to, based upon all this documentation, to become a part of the two lineage societies, one of which you had your mother in the National Society of Daughters of American Revolution. Of course, you also joined the lineage society. So tell us, how did this documentation that you were able to gather put you into the next level? Now, of course, I'm seeing more questions, and the callers, I really do want to have your questions asked. So I am going to have a question coming out of area code 770, and then Michael will go back and talk about the lineage societies, okay? Okay, area code 770, you have a question or a comment?
I think that might be me. This is Ruth, and I'm wondering, and you might have just asked the question, which is what other documents, like I'm sure there had to be many, many documents. What, name some of the key documents, I guess, that you were able to find in addition to the Freedom Papers, the manumission documents, to even really prove that Agnes and this person who helped her were actually related to you.
Well, that's a good question, Ruth. One of the things that, again, there are so many little details of piecing this puzzle together. A couple of other documents that I found necessary was I needed to be able to bring the two, Agnes and Matthew DeVoe, together. As I mentioned earlier, my cousin gave me this line diagram with these names, and I found the name of Matthew DeVoe, but in the manumission document, there was a guy by the name of Matthew Platia. And in the book, I explain how the challenge that I had to go through in terms of making the connection between Matthew DeVoe and Matthew Platia and Agnes. And that's where the book gets into the nitty-gritty details. And to explain it all, I want to give away all of the book right now, because I could sit down and tell you the book itself. But I had to find some type of documentation that will tie Agnes and Matthew DeVoe and Platia together. And I was successful in doing that with using a last will and testament. I found two of those. And the first last will and testament allowed me to bring the names together to identify Matthew as the person that was related to my Agnes. But I also had to identify, use some other documents, some additional census records, some militia lists, because I mentioned this guy, Platia, I discovered was a member of the New Orleans militia. Now, I get into greater detail of how I went through that process of determining that this guy, Platia, was also related to me. And so I had to identify. Once I got all of that straightened out, I had a clear picture that I was a great grandson, a fourth generation great grandson of this enslaved woman, and now I'm connecting myself to this guy who was a member of the militia. When I did that, I found myself to be eligible through an invitation that was given to me to become a member of the National Society of Sons of the American Revolution. And in 2009, I took on the challenge of continuing the documentation, did the application process, and I went full forth and actually had that accomplished. I did that for a reason. I wanted to take the research to another level. Oftentimes, many family historians and genealogists get into this endless cycle of just trying to find more. You never have enough. And I wanted to be an example of, okay, I think I have enough to, one, tell a story, but two, to document it, but three, to get into a lineage society, because it's at that point where you're taking the work that you've done all of these years and you're laying it out so that a third party is going to look at it objectively and see whether or not you've gathered all of the necessary evidence to connect yourself to these various generations, which I did. I was able to do that. And by doing that, submitting the application in 2010, I was accepted and joined the National Society, Sons of the American Revolution. I did not want to stop there, being the first one in the family to become a member of the National Society, Sons of the American Revolution. And again, it's a male lineage society, and the sister portion of the Sons of the American Revolution is called the Daughters of the American Revolution. These are some of the oldest societies in the United States, and they're designed primarily for descendants to be able to document their ancestral lineage to a patriot of the American Revolution, but also they become what I term a living memorial to the life and service of these members. And generally, you would become a member through the research of someone before you, like your mother, your grandmother. And it's oftentimes a rite of passage for some individuals who are actually born into a family where the grandmother, grandfather have already become members, and the mother is already a member, the father is already a member, and the children come along, become members of the. That didn't happen for me. So it was almost like a kind of a backwards way of coming into this by having to do it first. Then I realized my mom is still alive today with me. And because I traced it along her lineage, it was important that she, too, have her family documented, or the lineage documented with her name on a certificate. And she also became the member of the DR. So my mom and I are the first and only right now. But all of my siblings, all of my brothers and sisters and my cousins, they are all not eligible to become members of the National Society, Sons and Daughters of the American Revolution, because of this research that I've done. But I also wanted to explain a little bit about the importance of this and why it's important to become members of these lineage societies, because it's within these societies where you get to share. You become an example to others who may not see individuals such as yourself, and I could actually vouch for that right now, because in 2009, I became the first African-American in the state of Georgia, inducted into the National Society, Sons of the American Revolution in Georgia. Now, I was not looking to become a first. I just wanted to document my family's history. But then I found out later on that I was the first to do this. Now, I don't know if it's because no one has actually done it and tried it before me, but it struck me as a little odd that either the opportunity had not been available or someone may not have been able to go back that far. I wanted to dismiss that notion that persons of color could not identify an ancestor back that far. Oftentimes you have to do this research yourself in order to come to that conclusion. And so it's open and it's available. And so using myself as an example, I wanted to go ahead on through the whole process and document it. So in 2010, I became a member of the Georgia Society. Within 2 years later, in 2012, I rose up to the position as the president of a local chapter.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. That, too, was a mark in history. Now, you know, history is either made one of two ways. Either it's done on purpose or it's by happenstance, or you find yourself involved in something that later on you realize that it was a historic moment. And I wanted to be the voice to be able to write it out and to share it with people in my own words, because at some point in time, if it may not have been important to anybody today, it will probably become important to someone tomorrow, because it is now written, it's now in my words, it's now there for perpetuity. So that too was another motivation for this journey, this discovery, this process, this analysis, and then this documentation as an example to others that it can be done, it should be done, and we have an obligation to our ancestors to help tell their stories, because we now become the voice. We become that living memorial to be able to speak about the service and contributions that they gave forward to us as descendants. And that's pretty much the reason why this is how I've come together.
Well, I think that this, you are the voice, and it is absolutely wonderful that you were able to put this evidence together. And this is something that could be shared with school children. I mean, just to think, you are the first. And you now have that testament to show that, number one, the documentation is out there. And you were able to get that documentation, that proof, as you said, got proof. That's a wonderful statement to make about your document, about your book. And it's something that I think all genealogists strive to have. They strive to have the proof, the evidence. And the big question for me to ask you is, how long did it take?
Well, again, it's been a long journey. The whole process has evolved over about a 25 to 30 year period of coming into this awareness that, one, I had a connection that was a rich connection to a heritage that goes back to this period of time in French and Spanish colonial Louisiana. The actual documentation and putting it all together so that I can actually submit an application, that I would say would have been about a year and a half to put all of the documents, gather the types of documents necessary for me to become a member of the National Society, Sons of the American Revolution. As I said, I did that in 2010. I have since joined another lineage society. I discovered that my patriot ancestor, who served in the Revolution in Louisiana, had a son who, when the second revolution came around, which was the Battle of New Orleans, the War of 1812, at the age of 20, he stepped forward and provided a service to the country that called him forward. And I discovered that he was one of about 250 men of color that served under General Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans. And last year, I submitted the application, because again, it was running through the same line. I'd already done the documentation. It was just the next step of just joining the Lineage Society, and I joined the General Society of War of 1812. I don't know if many of your audience know, but last June of 2012 was the beginning of the bicentennial of the War of 1812 that started in 1812, but it actually culminated in Louisiana, in New Orleans, January 8th, 1815. And so there's a three-year celebration that's going on with these various commemorations throughout the country, and it's going to kind of culminate in New Orleans in 2015. And I wanted to be one of those descendants in that number, representing my ancestor who fought at the Battle of New Orleans. And what I've been trying to do is talk with individuals that I know that can trace their ancestry to these men of color primarily, that, you know, we really owe these folks this service to be able to do that, because we acknowledge the fact that they served their country when it was called, and we are alive today because of the service that they provided for us. And as descendants, who better to tell their story than us? By our presence, we are here. And by documenting it and becoming a member of the Lineage Societies, you become a part of that, the narrative of the new history of how your ancestor became a member of a particular militia group or a particular service. And so I'm someone on that campaign of, again, if you have the proof, if you have the documentation, become a part of the history-making moment when you can document your ancestor and make that happen.
Absolutely. Now, Michael, how can we order your book? The chatters want to know, the people on the line, how can they get a copy of your book?
Well, first of all, you can go to my blog, Finding Agnes Mathieu at blogspot.com, and there is an order button where you can actually order the book from there, and you can stipulate from that link that you would like me to sign, and I would be happy to sign an autographed copy of your book. So that's one place that you can go. So Finding Agnes Mathieu at findingagnesmathieu.blogspot.com, or just go to Google and type in Finding Agnes, A-G-N-E-S, Finding Agnes. The other way is through Amazon.com. Everybody knows how to go to Amazon and just type in the title, Got Proof, My Genealogical Journey, or either type in my name, and those are the two places where the book can be purchased at this moment. I'm also scheduling right now some book signing events that will be coming out, and if you go to my Got Proof Facebook page and press the like button, you'll have a continual an awareness of where I will be within the next 6 months in terms of book signings and things like that. But those are the two places where you can order the book and have it sent out to you today. And I hope my major hope of this book is that it first inspires you, because again, I'm just like you. Everyone that's listening to me right now, I'm just like you when you started off. Even if you've gotten to a certain point, do not give up. Continue to move forward, because your ancestors want you to find them. Once you get to that, I call a sweet spot, you will find that things will start to come to you by association with other people that are doing research, amazingly come to you in ways that you cannot even explain. And if you don't do anything else, just continue, because you will find the answers that you seek. I went looking to find the answers, and I not only became the family historian, but I've also become the storyteller. I went looking for somebody to help tell the story, and I became that person which I thought and I seek. And so I really implore people to continue on and not to give up. It can be frustrating at times. There are many moments when I've sat down and I've had to look at my ancestors in a different limelight and realize what they've gone through for me to be able to be in the position that I am today. And all I'm just doing right now is recording their life's history and their story and sharing it with the listening, the audience, and the public.
Right, and you are such a wonderful storyteller. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your parting words that, you know, the ancestors definitely don't want you to. And I just want to really thank you so much for your parting words. You know, the ancestors definitely want you to tell that story. Well, I hope everyone will join me next week. And the host of the show next week will be Natan Elaine Kemp. And she will welcome Susan E. Smith for a discussion of her book, Funeral Directors and the African American Way of Death. Now, this book explores the role of funeral directors in African American life and their participation in the national civil rights movement. To Serve the Living was a finalist for the Library of Virginia's Nonfiction Literary Award in 2011. So I'd like to say good night and thank you, Michael Nolden Henderson. And remember, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives and beyond. Now, I want to say to everyone, I really look forward to seeing all of you at the Midwest African American Genealogy Institute in St. Louis next week. Now, you can continue this discussion on the Genealogy and History Forum of Afrogenius.com and the research at the National Archives and beyond Facebook page. Thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio Show. This show is sponsored by BB's Genealogy and Educational Services, LLC, and the website is www.genieberoots.com. That's genieberoots.com. So good night, and I look forward to you joining the show next Thursday. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. Good night. Good night, Michael.